Who is a silver saint, past or present, that has influenced you and your life for good? Who is a senior saint, probably more than one, and how is it that they have influenced you? That's a question I want to ask you and be thinking of this. And if you'd like to respond to my question, respond to me, I'd love to know about it. And again, I want to find a way of sharing that with our Creekwood family. Been thinking about that with the Silver Saints luncheon this afternoon. That was a lot of fun. And I think we wore everybody out. But it was a whole lot of fun. Appreciate all those who were involved in putting that on and all those who were in attendance. In Herbert Lockyer's book, All of the Women of the Bible, he gives this historical anecdote. Benjamin Franklin, who was ridiculed at one time in Paris for his defense of the Bible, was determined to find out how much of it his scoffers had actually read. He informed one of the learned societies that he had come across about a story of pastoral life in ancient times that he wanted to share with them to see what they thought about it. And so a night was arranged for Franklin to read to the assembly of scholars this story of pastoral life in ancient times that had impressed him greatly. Benjamin Franklin, being a Bible lover, read the book of Ruth on this occasion. And when he had finished, according to this source, says that they were just enraptured with this story. And they urged Benjamin Franklin, "You need to print that story." To which, of course, he said, "It's already in print. It's a part of the Bible that you ridicule." It is a beautiful story. In fact, in studying about the providence of God, and Brother Bob Hanks sharing with me an article that he wrote about the providence of God as seen in the book of Ruth that was published in the Gospel Advocate about 2 years ago, without my knowing until recently. It really got me to studying more about the book, but instead of giving an overview, I just had to spend a little more time with it. And I hope it'll be worth the journey for you as well. So I invite you to open your Bibles to the book of Ruth this evening. We'll look in chapter 1. But the heroine of this narrative, of course, is Ruth the Moabitess, a non-Israelite, a foreigner, who through the blessing of God became the great-grandmother of King David, and also an ancestress of the blessed Messiah of Jesus himself. One of four women listed in the family tree, if you will, earthly wise, of Jesus. Samuel may have been the penman of the book. We don't know for certain. The book was written probably sometime during the reign of David or the United Kingdom. However, the book is set during the time of Judges. We learn that from chapter 1 and verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. But it's during the time of the judges. One writer talked about the time of the judges in a broad perspective. He said it tells a gloomy story of social chaos, disobedience to God, oppression, deliverance, and apostasy. Whenever I think about the book of Judges, I think about these cycles that the people of Israel would go through. How that they would be in a good relationship with God, but then would be influenced by idolatrous nations around them and worship those idols. And God would raise up a nation against them as punishment, to which the people of Israel would cry out for a deliverer. And God would raise up a judge to deliver them from their enemy, but also to bring them back to God. And so they'd come back up here to the top of the circle in my mind, but then it wouldn't be long before they'd be influenced again by idolatrous people around them. So you have seven of those cycles in the book of Judges. And you read about some horrible practices of these idolatrous people, those practices that the Israelites would engage in. So it is a gloomy story. But the book of Ruth is set during that time. It, instead of a gloomy story, is a beautiful story of devotion and love and faithfulness in the midst of all this. As we read in verse 1, there was a famine in the land, a famine in Israel. And some suggest that Ruth's story may fit in the days of Gideon, the judge Gideon, because there was a famine in the land when he was called to be a judge. We don't know for certain. However, it is fair to conclude, one writer suggests, that the famine was a special judgment upon the people of God. Again, when the people of God would go into idolatry and these practices of these false gods, God would punish them, sometimes with a foreign nation, a foreign power, sometimes with famine. And perhaps this famine that Elimelech and Naomi and that impact the life of Ruth as well is because of God's punishment of the nation of Israel. But the scene for Ruth chapter 1 is the high plateau east of the Dead Sea and south of the Arnon River. You see it on the map here. South and east of Bethlehem on the other side of the Dead Sea. The Moabites historically were descendants of Lot and the incestuous union with one of his daughters, Genesis chapter 19. And the Moabites, we read, worship the pagan deity Chemosh as their god. So they were also an idolatrous people. I mentioned Elimelech. Let me list the major characters in the book of Ruth and also the meaning of some of the names, some of which are disputed. But names are often significant, and they're very significant in the book of Ruth. Elimelech is the man that we read about in verse 1 that's unnamed at that point. A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab. We'll read in just a moment that man's name was Elimelech, which means my God is king. His wife's name is Naomi, which means pleasant, or some other sources suggest my sweet one or amiable, Naomi. Kilion is one of Elimelech's and Naomi's sons. And this is disputed, but some suggest his name means sickness or sickly. And others suggest that they may have named him this because as a baby, he may have been sickly. Perhaps also his brother Mahlon was, because his name, according to some sources, means consumption or wasting away. Perhaps these babies suffered physically, were weak, were sickly when they were babies. Orpah is another major character. This is the wife of Kilion. It is said that her name means stiff-necked. But Ruth, again, the major character, her name has been assigned the meaning of friend or refreshment or comfort. I have to wonder, were some of these meanings attached to the names because of the story in the book of Ruth, quite frankly? But these names, these meanings assigned to Ruth's name would certainly be true as far as Ruth's relationship with her mother-in-law, Naomi. And we'll see that very, very clearly. So as you open your Bibles to Ruth chapter 1, let's do some reading. In the first five verses, we could caption this paragraph as 10 years of tragedy. 10 years of tragedy. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Notice again, the reason that they went to the country of Moab was because of the famine in the land of Judah. Verse 3, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Verse 5, then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. So 10 years of tragedy. First of all, there's that famine, and they respond to it by going to another land, perhaps where they can find bread, and they stay there 10 years altogether. And again, perhaps the famine was a judgment of God upon the nation of Israel, of Judah, because of their evil practices. We're not told exactly. Some believe that Elimelech was not justified in making this move, that he should have remained in the land. There's not enough evidence to me to prove that. But some would even suggest that the death of these three men was due to, in the case of Elimelech, to his leaving the land of Judah, and to the two sons because they married strange or foreign women. We do find in the law of Moses that they were strictly instructed not to marry women of foreign nations, idolatrous nations. This was against the law of Moses. Jewish commentators have generally regarded the death of those two sons as an evidence of divine judgment because they did intermarry with these foreign women. Again, I like Burton Kaufman's comment. We're not told why Elimelech or either of his sons died, merely that they died and left Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth, widows in Moab, with no visible means of support. If it wasn't punishment, it would not be uncommon for these deaths to occur. Jerry Gifford has some good insights. Let me read to you from him. Now, why were two sickly children born to such a nice couple? And why did famines come? For that matter, why do any natural disasters occur? Why does anyone face a long-term illness? Or why does any hard worker lose his or her job? Why does the market take a downturn? Apart from specific occasions, Jerry Gifford says, where God indicates that he sent or allowed adversity for a specific purpose, we don't know exactly. However, we must guard against blaming anyone for the things we don't know. For the most part, these stressing circumstances happen because we live in a sin-cursed world. What if Elimelech died just from natural causes? What if, this is only a suggestion, what if Mahlon and Chilion died because they'd been sickly since they were small? And there were some harsh times that they had endured. It's not necessarily punishment. But for these three women, Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, the future looked very, very bleak for them. And again, we know the rest of the story, but I challenge us, let's go through it as they lived it. And here is a woman who's growing older, two daughters-in-law. Their husbands, all husbands, have died. And so they're wondering, how are we going to make ends meet? How are we going to survive? And they're living in Moab, and for Naomi, that's a foreign land. And Orpah and Ruth have married into this Hebrew family, but now their husbands are gone. Again, from their standpoint, the future looks very, very bleak. Notice with me, beginning verse 6, the journey to Bethlehem. Then she, Naomi, arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab, notice, that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. This language would suggest that that famine perhaps was punishment from God, but now he's blessing his people again. So Naomi hears, hey, they have bread back at home, so I'm going to go back to my homeland. Verse 7. Therefore she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. Remember that Orpah and Ruth are from Moab. That's where they were born. That's where they were raised. That's where they'd been living. But when their mother-in-law, that probably was now like a second mother to them, determines that she's going to go back to Judah, they resolve to go with her. I think that's commendable, don't you? They want to help her, I'm thinking. And so they're willing to leave their homeland in order to go and help their mother-in-law. Verse 8. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead," referring to her husband and her sons, "and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. So, don't go with me. Go back to your mother's house, and may you find rest in the house of your husband. And it seems to me she is thinking they're young, they'll probably marry again. And if that happens, then may you find rest in the house of your husband-to-be. But Naomi is giving them an out. You don't have to go with me. Go back to your homeland. Go back to your family. And may God bless you. May he deal kindly with you as you have dealt with my family. Verse 10. And they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." Again, a noble quest here. A generous offer for them to accompany her to them, a foreign land. Verse 11, Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters." I think that's beautiful. Not daughters-in-law. "Turn back, my daughters." You'll find it three times in these three verses. "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them?" Would you wait for them to grow up so that you can marry them? "Would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So no. Go stay in your homeland. There's no way I can bear sons for you to marry again. But notice that phrase at the end of verse 13 from Naomi's perspective. "The hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Naomi sees these events as, in some way, God is against her. She doesn't know the rest of the story, even as we do. But she knows that she's been through some tragic events in 10 years in this foreign land. But little does she know that God was preparing some wonderful things for her future. May we be reminded. It may seem, because of circumstances that you and I are facing, God must be against me. He must be punishing me for some reason. But be assured that for the faithful child of God, God is preparing wonderful things for your future. Verse 14, then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, and this was a kiss goodbye, wasn't it? She was going to stay in Moab. She was not going to accompany Naomi back to Judah. But Ruth, it says, clung to her. She's going to stay with her. In fact, the next few verses are some of the most beautiful verses in all of Scripture. But they reflect a daring decision on the part of Ruth. For Ruth, the choice was different than that of Orpah's. She loved Naomi, was willing to leave her own land and share the unknown future with the aging woman in whom her life was intertwined. Again, this passage is the most beautiful statement of commitment in printed literature. It's no wonder to me that those scoffers of the Bible in Paris, when Benjamin Franklin read this story, were just enamored by it and said, "This must be printed, because it's such a beautiful story, and these few verses are some of the most beautiful words in it." But in Ruth's statement here to Naomi, I believe we find the characteristics of genuine commitment to a relationship. And that first characteristic is that it's costly. It's costly. Ruth 1:16. But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." Ruth had to sacrifice a great deal personally to maintain this relationship with her mother-in-law, and to be willing to go with her. And I hope that we're able to put it in perspective. She's a Moabite. She grew up in Moab. She grew up probably worshiping the false god Chemosh. Her mother's still living, apparently. But yet she has married this Hebrew man who is now dead. Her mother-in-law has lost her husband. Her sister-in-law lost her husband. And now she's faced with her mother-in-law that's leaving to go back home. And Ruth, it seems to me, out of pure devotion and generosity of heart, wants to go with her and help her. She loves her dearly. So she made these sacrifices that had to do with her future. "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you." She was willing to sacrifice her freedom for the responsibility of caring for Naomi. For all Ruth knew at this point, she would never remarry, never have children. She was willing to devote her life into helping to care for her mother-in-law. As a widow herself, she was committing to care for her aging widowed mother-in-law. It was a complete break with the past without any promise for the future. This commitment to this relationship was costly. It affected her. It impacted her future. It impacted her familiarity. "Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge." Again, Moab was the place of familiarity. It was her national identity, her homeland. But she was willing to leave the land where she was born and raised for a land with new and strange customs, a land where she would even have to ask herself, "Are they going to accept me because I'm a foreigner?" But she was willing to risk this, to sacrifice this. She gave up her family and friends. "Your people," she says to Naomi, "shall be my people." She was willing to sacrifice a close relationship with her family of origin. She was leaving behind her mother, her extended family, her friends, to accompany her mother-in-law to Judah. This decision was costly. It also impacted her faith. Notice, "Your God shall be my God. And this causes some questions for me, at least. Here she was willing to sacrifice her religious heritage and the worship of the false god, Chemosh. And we would wonder how much of an impact had Elimelech and Naomi and Mahlon and Chilion, how much of an impact had they had on Ruth and Orpah as far as their theological understanding? Had they been able to teach them about the one true living God and how that Chemosh was a false god? And I would like to say that they had made that impact. And that there are some evidences that Ruth's faith in the one true living God was genuine. With all we know about Ruth, in fact, Herbert Lockyer wrote, it is quite possible that she warmly received all her husband may have told her of the mighty Jehovah. And he, in fact, later states in his book, in spite of her heathen background and association with the degenerated tribe of Moab, Ruth became a devout worshiper of the true God. But this decision that she was making to stay with Naomi impacted her faith. It was a costly decision. Secondly, it was a long-term decision. Notice as we continue, verse 17, Ruth says to Naomi, where you die, I will die. I'm with you until we die. Here's an aside. There was a college man walked into a photography studio with a framed picture of his girlfriend. He wanted the picture duplicated. Well, this involved removing this picture from the frame. And when the person at the photography studio did this, she saw an inscription on the back and she read it. And she read, my dearest Tom, I love you with all my heart. I love you more and more each day. I will love you forever and ever. I'm yours for an eternity. And it was signed, Diane. But then there was a postscript, a P.S. that said, if we ever break up, I want this picture back. That doesn't speak to long term, does it? But notice Ruth's statement. Where you die, I will die. That sounds like a till death do us part type of commitment, doesn't it? She didn't approach her relationship with the attitude, if things get tough or don't work out the way I want, I can leave. No, she had the attitude that if things don't work out, I'll work harder attitude. It's not an option. Where you die, I will die. It implies faithfulness. It demonstrates commitment that will hold relationships together. It was costly, it was long-term, and it was sacred. Last part of verse 17, Ruth says to Naomi, the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. That's a form of an oath. It's an oath that we see, this ancient oath, in the books of Samuel and Kings. So she's making an oath. She's making a commitment to Naomi, but also in the presence of God. May the Lord do so to me. May He take my life if anything but death separates you and me. And here's one of those glimpses into the faith of Ruth. Burton Kaufman points out the great significance of this oath is that Ruth does not say Elohim, doesn't use that term for God as a foreigner would, but rather she uses Jehovah or Yahweh, indicating that Ruth is a follower of the true God. May Jehovah do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. In effect, she's invoking the punishment of God if she should let anything less than death part her from Naomi. Beautiful statement, isn't it? I love verse 18 as well. When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. Here's what I envision in my mind. Let's say they're traveling by wagon. I'm thinking Ruth has gotten up into the wagon with her suitcases in hand and is saying, "Are you coming or not?" But she is determined. "I'm not taking no for an answer. This is the end of the discussion. Where you die, I'm going to die. And so let's go." But Naomi senses from Ruth that Ruth has made up her mind. It's pointless to try to dissuade her. That Naomi knew that Ruth was going to stay with her, even though it was costing her so much. Alexander White once said, "There's not a love story comparable to the love of the Moabite daughter-in-law for her Hebrew mother-in-law." Ruth's declaration of love and loyalty for Naomi marks it out as being the purest and most unselfish form of devotion. And I suggest to you, Ruth's relationship with her mother-in-law is a great definition of loving commitment, which is so needed in our relationships. Brother Bob, in his article, pointed out, you know, as I have heard many times this statement used in weddings, and that's not a direct application, but by extension, it's a wonderful application because it speaks to and defines what real loving commitment is all about. It's needed in our relationships, in our family, and with our friends, with our church family. But it must be a part of our relationship with God. It must define our relationship with God. I want to conclude with this statement. Life is full of challenges and difficult circumstances. Think about what Naomi and Ruth and Orpah have been through. We can agree, and especially when we look at the backdrop of their lives, life is full of challenges and difficult circumstances. While one cannot control the actions of another, he or she can make the commitment to hold the family together. Ruth sacrificed so much in order to accomplish that. "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Where you die, I will die. May the Lord take my life if nothing but death separates you and me." That's loving commitment. Does it describe the commitment that we have for one another? But even more importantly, does it describe the commitment that we have to God? Perhaps tonight you're ready to make a similar statement to God. A determination to follow Him till death. And it may be that you're ready to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, or perhaps we need to get back on track and we desire the prayers of the church on our behalf. If you're subject to the invitation of Christ, we hope that you'll let that be known as together we stand and sing.